You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. We welcome David Livermore back to the podcast. He has a PhD. He is a social scientist devoted to the topics of cultural intelligence, which he calls CQ, and global leadership. And he's the author of several award-winning books. His latest edition. The book is called Leading with Cultural Intelligence, The Real Secret to Success. You're going to love this pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
But David Livermore, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Kelly. Great to be here.
So if there's one thing that is said over and over in this book, and it's correct, is that words are important. Words matter. And I'd love to start this conversation with trying to define culture, because this is a thing that gets squishy, and it's not, I don't think it is. And I think you've honed in on it. So can you talk to us about sort of your personal definition of culture?
Yeah. So I think in part there's the sociologist definition. It's the beliefs, values, assumptions, behaviors that distinguish one group from another. I actually lean more toward this idea that you often hear more with organizational culture, is it's sort of the taken for granted way of the way we do things around here, you know? And yeah. So I think, you know, from the book that I talk about this notion of figured worlds, and it's all these different places where I've slowly sort of been socialized to figure out how to live. So even in my own work, the default is often thinking culture as in China versus American. But you and I have talked about before, the political cultures of blue versus red may actually have far more relevance to what I'm wrestling with in the workplace or with my family members, etc. So yeah, just it's the taken for granted thoughts, beliefs, attitudes that just sort of govern the way we go about life.
And with both culture and this idea of figured worlds, and this has come across in a number of recent interviews, which is there are many cultures within cultures, figured worlds within figured worlds. They change, they morph, they're context dependent. So all of these things make it way more complex, of course. But also, once you understand that that is the norm, and this is totally an improv thing, which is like, you know, see these obstacles as gifts and as incredible opportunities. And if you can somehow embody yourself and present yourself with that mindset, that's the advantage. It's not that you're going to get everything right, because there's no way that's going to happen.
Yes. And what else I like about what you just said is sometimes culture sounds like it's just this deterministic thing that happens to us, and as if we don't have any agency. And, you know, your realm of improv, it's like, no, I am myself helping shape the cultures of which I'm part.
That's right. You're right. All right. You took this trip to Liberia.
Right.
I think it's a great example, because you use it early in the book as sort of like, here's what we're talking about. So can you kind of give us that story?
Yeah, so I'm going to Liberia on behalf of the university where I was working at the time, and we were trying to set up some extension work there relatively post the war. And, you know, we didn't want to be the U.S. institution that just thinks we arrive and we don't collaborate with any other institution. So we had identified a university that we really wanted to partner with. But I kept hearing through the grapevine, and particularly from my host, that, oh, the leader of this Liberian university is corrupt. And there's part of me, it's like, okay, here we go again. The Africans are all corrupt. Come on. Yeah. But he started to give me some substantive examples, but he tells me that the guy we're meeting with the next morning has a lot of direct experience at the university. You know, I should see what I can learn from it. So I go in, you know, I'm a relatively diplomatic guy, but early on into the conversation, I'm like, yeah, I wonder if you can tell me about some of these rumors we've heard about the university and the president there. And he doesn't answer the question at all. You know, it'd be very good for Liberia if you partner with them. And it's a great school. I'm honored to be there. I'm like, okay, yes, but what about this individual, these things? We've heard he's embezzled money. And, you know, I think I probably even said something like, I don't need you to go into the gory details, but is there something there? Once again, it'd be very good for the students if you partner. And, you know, he's still not really giving me anything on the guy. And at the very end, he just says something like, we've known each other for years, and then still just kind of says something generic about the university. So I walk out, and my host, who had, you know, advised me about the cautions of working with this school, I'm like, wow, well, that was interesting. He's like, don't you get it, David? Like, he wasn't going to tell you that this guy's corrupt. He's his Liberian brother. You're this outsider he just met this morning. I'm like, well, I expect him to tell me the truth, you know, like I'm sure I even assured confidentiality. And so, you know, I was already well into the world of studying culture at that point. And it was so jarring for me to think that my, you know, I was living in the Midwest at that point, my Midwest nicety, diplomacy still ended up being pretty abrupt and blunt to this guy. And eventually, as you know, later in the book, I talk about, I have another chance to come at it with another individual who, with, you know, just the two of us alone in the room, starts to at least hint toward, maybe you should look into this or you should talk to this person.
So this reminds me a little bit, I talk about this a lot when I get hired to speak, which is, so we're taught in improvisation to be others focused, and everyone generally gets this idea of, like, because we do, we focus on ourselves, we put more judgment on ourselves often than we do with other people, and when you can really focus on the other person and listen to the other person, all that, which all makes great sense. And then when we were working with the folks at the Booth School, and we were introduced to William Swan, who has this idea around self-verification theory, and what Swan says is that rather than individuals wanting to be seen as their best selves, prettiest selves, smartest selves, we want to be seen as we see ourselves. So if I see myself as clumsy, I want you to see me as clumsy, but I'm not going to tell you that. So then you have to figure that out. And that was that layer deeper that I think we're talking about, which is like, oh, it's not just that someone, it's okay, what is driving them? And then how do you get to that? And the only way, we can't read minds. The only way we can get to that is like asking a lot of questions. And I think what you're saying too, culturally, one has to then tread in a certain way with those questions or find alternative routes to get to that truth.
Two thoughts. First of all, yes, I really like Swan's work and your connection to that. And at times it feels like a curse to be the guy that talks about cultural intelligence. And I'm often doing it in very diverse settings. So like, damn, I better like get this right. The other piece, and I've thought about this a lot from a previous conversation with you, you told me one time that, you know, a lot of people who got up on stage at Second City thought they were all that because they were so good at the improv thing. And you were like, actually, it's they were paired with really good improv people who knew what to do or something like that.
Yep, that's it.
And in some ways, I would say, you know, that's what I'm after in terms of helping people develop capabilities to work with culture. Like you adjust so well that they might not even have a sense that there was a cultural difference involved there, but that you're kind of taking the lead on helping them improvise and dealing with you as a North American or a white guy or a different political stripe or whatever it might be.
Well, there's the agency again, right? So like everyone has agency in these situations, and yes, there's status and there's other things, but we talk about this a lot too, which is, comedy is such a status ridden thing, especially the old duos, you know, Laurel and Hardy, Martin and Lewis. And you could always tell who was high status, who was low status. That was the game they're playing. But in all those situations, it's the low status person who gets the leg up. They use that sort of place. And so it's also sort of understanding you can have an advantage sometimes when you have that lower status, and you have a disadvantage when you have the higher status. That's not a way I think people talk about a lot.
And in my space, one of the ways that I sometimes suggest to people, like in that situation in Liberia, even if I had said, I know this is going to be very American of me, but I don't know how else to say this. It's kind of like I'm almost playing to, I know I'm an ugly American with the kind of question. But instead, you know, I come in worried about my status as well as his. So that's an interesting parallel, again, with the actors in improv with our work and culture.
You have a section in the first chapter where you challenge some well-worn adages. And I'd love to talk about these because I know why you're doing it, because all of these are things that are said in leadership books, you know, that sort of thing. One of them is admit your mistakes openly to build trust.
Yeah.
So that seems like, oh yeah, being a bit vulnerable. That's people like that. I've talked about that before, but what's the downside on that?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard for me to challenge because it certainly is what I appreciate. Like, yeah, just own up to your stuff, but that's because of how I've been socialized from my figured worlds and culture. What I would say is, everybody across culture when studying wants a leader who, you know, can admit their mistakes and be humble. But the way in which you do that. So, for example, I've been in settings where, you know, somebody who values that admit you're wrong publicly will go on and on effusively about how it was wrong. And someone from a more saving face culture is like, why are they groveling on and on about this? Show me through your actions that you apologize, talk about it more generically so we don't have to feel embarrassed. Or we all know what it's like if I were to suddenly, you know, call you up after this is done and be like, oh, Kelly, I blew that. Like sometimes now I'm putting more onus on you to say, no, Dave, it wasn't that bad. Or I've seen, you know, so in some ways it becomes
That's
more
happened.
About the recipient, not by me, but
not by you.
No, I can only imagine. So yeah, I think it's just, like there's a kernel of truth to that sage advice. Like people want their leaders to demonstrate some humility, but the way in which I want you to show your humility varies according to culture as well as personality and other variables.
Another one is get to the point.
Yeah, which you must feel when you're interviewing people. But especially in a business setting, you know, you're told very much like, knock the ball out of the park. There's a nice American idiom, right? And get to the point within the first minute or two where you're going to lose them. And especially, you know, if you're making a pitch to someone, bottom line results. But, you know, if you're dealing with academics, and I know you spend a lot of time with academics, if you're dealing with engineers, if you're dealing with someone in Germany, oftentimes if you start with the point before you've actually shown the process you use to get to the point, it's like, this is just superficial McKinsey consulting stuff, which I don't mean to slam McKinsey, but they're sort of the epitome of nice slide deck, bottom line, executive summary. And wait, what was all the rigor that went into getting there? So people want us to be clear, but my definition of clear might be get to the point, and your definition of clear might be show me your work and then show me the point based upon the work that you went through.
So this literally happened like an hour ago. I have a colleague, a relatively new colleague, who is a very sort of brass tacks kind of guy. That's his thing. And I had actually set up for him an introductory meeting with a group. And the group got on the call. He's telling me this, that they got on the call and immediately they made the ask, the thing that they wanted from him. And then he responded, it's nice to meet you. And I was just like, he's like, what are you doing? Like, this is a get to know you call. And it was so, I'm like, oh yeah, that's great. And he's like, look, we have a 30-minute call. We want to talk sort of the business things. That's a 90-minute call. So that'll be our next one. And they sort of got into it. But it was very funny because I was like, oh, that is that point. Okay. Rule of three. I got to ask you a third one. Ask people what they want. Mm. Now that's seemingly, you know, a great advice.
It is. And I get responded to with this all the time when I'll be like, you may not know, for example, you may not know whether or not your people want you to grovel or whether they want you just to more implicitly demonstrate humility. And often the reaction is, I just ask them. And, you know, back to the status thing, if I have a lot more status than you and I ask you what you want, what's the right answer? Like, well, what the boss thinks that I want or whatever. So of course, again, the kernel of truth, there's an orientation of consider the other people's perspective, but even take culture out of it. Just you have age, seniority, personality, you're assuming they're just going to be upfront with it. But then culture adds another layer of, oh, they're asking me what I want, but that's not really what I'm being asked to do. And there's without enough psychological safety, which we might get into, there's not enough like safety for me to really say what I want. That's where, again, I would say culture skews whether or not people are clearly telling you what they want when you ask them.
What I think is interesting too about the psychological safety research is a lot of people don't sort of know the full story there. So they certainly, we understand the idea that the ability to talk about mistakes in an open environment, that's all great. But the research actually goes a step further, which is like, and you got to feel like you're not going to get punished. And you've got to also make sure that the minority viewpoint in the room feels safe to share this. Because if you don't have that, there is no psychological safety. And there's a social tax for saying no. And that's a thing that people don't always understand.
Yeah, and there is a lot of adoption of psychological safety that looks at part one of what you said without part two.
Part two.
And, you know, it became super trendy, importantly so, post George Floyd, where a lot of people like, we need to, you know, really pay attention to this. But it did not really look at what are the dynamics that prevent people from being safe to speak up. And, you know, one of the leading experts on this, Amy Edmondson, I mean, a lot of people looked at her work at a cursory level and, oh, look at all the work she did with Google. You know, the psychologically safe teams were more innovative. They had higher revenue share, et cetera. But there wasn't an abundance of diversity on a lot of those teams that were initially surveyed. And so to your point, if you're the dissident voice, it may take a lot more than just like, this is a safe place, ask whatever you want or say whatever you want. It has to be a lot more behavior that sort of demonstrates that we really are a place that allows for that.
You write something that I think is important. You say, quote, respect doesn't equal agreement. No one is asking you to change what you believe, but leading effectively in today's world means leading everyone with respect and dignity, end quote. And this is the reason I wanted to point this out is I think it is, you know, there's a lot of questions about DEI training and good questions in terms of its effectiveness. I get that. But this idea that we can't or shouldn't adapt for other people that I don't know. This seems very much the lessons that we were taught in childhood that are pretty strong.
Yeah, and it's sort of a zero-sum game because if I say bringing my whole self is actually something that's offensive to you and you want to bring your whole self, then how does that actually work out? And it kind of, you know, harkens back to Goffman's work on really we're all presenting different selves at different times. So similar to you, I think there's an appropriate reason why DEI is talking about we need to feel more people, we need to give people more room that they don't have to cover to do it. But respect sometimes mean that I'm adjusting the behaviors that I use to allow you to feel like you can effectively be a part of this team.
There's a lot of good metaphors that you use in the book around this. And I've talked about this with my friends at the University of Chicago in terms of one of the problems in the sort of DEI settings is that really a lot of it is around people feeling they have a lack of competence. And when you feel you have a lack of competence, that's something you don't want to engage with. Like, you know, I don't golf. Like, and if you invited me out to, I would not accept an invitation because I don't want to look that dumb and that bad at something. That who would argue with that? And,
right.
But then you just, all you need to do is extend that metaphor a little bit into like, you know, it's as some people have a hard time with pronouns and don't want to get called out. I was telling you, I just talked to Kate McKinnon last night for the Chicago Humanities Festival, and she's on zero social media. And I asked her why, and she's like, because I don't want to get yelled at for saying the wrong thing.
Wow. And, you know, as an outsider, I'm like, why does Kate McKinnon care what anybody says to her? But
that's kind of what I said.
I forget that she's a human being.
You know, yeah, that's right. But this is that. But this is part of this, which is like, it's hard, and it's become increasingly hard because we're way more global. Our teams are way more diverse. I mean, the generation stuff to me is you know, I question some of that in regard to what we have understood about generations, what they truly care about at different times. So I think some of it's maybe overblown, but there's no question that we're getting brought into businesses like, help us with this generation issue.
Yeah. And more broadly to your point, we know there's all kinds of research for decades that has said diversity primes us to feel anxious when I'm encountering someone who's different than me. So whatever stripe of difference that is, if we link it back to, you know, your friends at Chicago that you've talked to about confidence, like, I don't like, believe me, that the next several meetings after that encounter in Liberia, I'm like, ah, crap, what am I missing this time? Yeah. And so sometimes DEI training, I think, wrongfully erodes people's confidence, and then they just retreat from the whole conversation. Like, I don't want to be called the next racist or the person who didn't use the pronouns right.
So here's the positive that you talk about for engaging these things. You say, quote, learning to negotiate the divergent perspectives on a team to work toward a shared outcome can foster a sense of creativity that can't be gained in any other way, end quote. Now, the other way it can be, that's improv. That is literally groups of, like, an improv game that you do together because you have the mission, which you also talk about in the book. And the mission is just to accomplish the point of focus of the game. That's it's very clear that that's what it is. And you do it with other people and it feels good. And that's what makes ensembles for us.
And the yes and that I would give that what you did there. Is, and the more diverse the group, the more improv I have to do if it's going to actually be doing. So I think we're saying the same thing. But
that's powerful, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it's, you know, it's a for a, your thoughtful audience is probably not counterintuitive, but it's a countercultural message in that I'm often having to say to people, no, diversity by itself does not lead to innovation. It leads to frustration. It leads to gridlock. In my language, I would say diversity plus cultural intelligence, which is a very academic term for applying improv to cross-cultural situations, that diversity times cultural intelligence leads to innovation. And we've researched that in a number of different ways to prove it.
So I just talked last week with Michael Morris and his new book, Tribal. And he has a really, I didn't know this story, and it ties up with when you talk about Iceland. But he was talking about the temperance movement and the research he did on how prohibition came to be. And it was essentially charismatic religious leaders tied with women who were tired of their husbands coming home drunk, staging these very public events in public squares, people seeing this on a weekly basis and making the assumption that, hey, people don't want alcohol anymore. Mm-hmm. And so prohibition happens. And then what happened about 5-6 years into this is a thing called polling that the newspaper started doing. And then when they did polling, they found that maybe around 80% of the people wanted their booze back. And so this is just like, well, that's what they saw. And then my son went to Iceland in high school on a trip, came back. The way he talked about it, I was like, I haven't been yet, but it's on our list of like, we got to go to Iceland. So what do you have about Iceland in the book?
Yeah, so it is this idea. I mean, I've not read Michael's book yet, but know him. It's this idea that we start to become shaped by our figure world, that we're social creatures. And so, you know, sometimes to come back to your earlier question of what is culture, like so often we think about it in terms of tribal rituals or all these culture could very much be like, all my friends are going to Iceland, so now I'm going to Iceland. And, you know, I'm watching a similar phenomenon with Portugal. Everyone suddenly is going to Lisbon. It's like, well, you know, was Lisbon any less beautiful 10 years ago than it is today, or Iceland suddenly? But they did a really strong marketing campaign that was then fueled by lots of people talking about it. So as much as we like to think about, you know, I make all these independent, logical choices, so many of our choices are shaped by the groups of which we're a part, which comes back to this impact of culture on who we are and what we do.
Can we talk about some of your examples of the mistakes that people have made? They're pretty funny. So one of them was the U.S. Dairy Association's Got Milk slogan.
Right.
What, Well, how did that not work in another?
That one was, are you lactating, right?
Yes. So that was Spanish. The translation,
yes,
whatever.
When they translated to Spanish, are you lactating? Not quite what they were going after.
No, not it. And you talk about a French business that opens its Thailand offices one floor above a statue of Buddha. So what was the problem there?
Yeah, and nobody would come because this was like clear disregard for the Buddha by putting yourself above it and in seniority. In one of those very subtle ways, I think particularly in Western culture, we think religion and business, we need to keep those two really separate. It's not the case in vast majority of the world, with Thailand being case in point.
So there's chapter five. This is one of my favorites because this is about like 10 cultural dimensions. And you talk about individualism versus collectivism. And that is a difference in identity. That's pretty big.
So core. Yep.
And the McDonald's example I thought was fascinating. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So, you know, we all know about the McDonald's Employee of the Month program. We've seen it when we've gone to McDonald's. When they rolled that out in India, it was like a demotivating factor. Like, you did not want to be the Employee of the Month because everyone was going to give you crap about it, because you had been brought up all your life that the sore thumb is the one that stands up and gets chopped off. Why do you think you're all that? So they improvised to make it the Team of the Month, the Shift of the Month, the Store of the Month, etc. And now suddenly it was highly motivating. So this is one of those things where you talked about, you know, some of those myths or adages of leadership that I challenge. You know, some of the research we talk about early in the book is that 90% of leadership content assumes an individualist, autonomous orientation, and yet 70% of the workforce is more collectivist in their orientation. So the things we read about recognition and how to motivate people and rewards are oriented toward 30% of the workforce rather than the 70% of the workforce that has a much more collectivist viewpoint.
I know you don't talk about this in the book, but I'm so curious if you thought about this. Is could that be happening in this country generationally?
Yes. No, I was almost going to say, to your point earlier, generationally. And it's interesting when you look at it, like the younger generation of the U.S. certainly still look way more individualist than, you know, their counterparts in China. But when you compare either one of them to the older generations, it's kind of going the opposite direction. China, yeah, they look more individualist compared to their parents. In the U.S., younger generation looks more collectivist. So absolutely.
Here was one that I was really, I didn't have the term for it. You have it as monochronic versus polychronic. So explain what that is.
Yeah. So monochronic is like you focus on one thing at a time, and polychronic, you're addressing lots of things simultaneously. And of course, in today's digital world, we all have to do some kind of focusing on lots of things at the same time. But, you know, in a very real example, as I've, you know, often like you, facilitated programs with leaders around the world. If you're in this country, for the most part, it's kind of deemed to be like respectful to be in a leadership session with your phone, you know, put away, or you would step out if you take a call, because we're a monochronic culture that would say we should at least pretend that we're fully engaged in what's happening in that conversation. I've been in places in the Middle East where there's no attempt to pretend that. There's people walking out to go to prayer. They come back in. They take a phone call, sometimes right in the same room. It can be very distracting as a facilitator. But polychronic is all of this stuff is all mixed together. And it's, as you know from how we talk about it in the book, it's often a way of even explaining time orientation and punctuality that, you know, you and I agreed to meet at the top of the hour today. But that if, you know, your spouse suddenly has something urgent that's going on in a polychronic orientation, well, Dave Livermore can wait. This isn't urgent. I'm going to attend to my spouse because they're the top priority. Whereas, you know, I think even in monochronic culture, we would do that if your spouse was having a real crisis and emergency. But if it's like, I just need to touch base with you for a few minutes, be like, no, I've got a work commitment that's happening right now.
That
I find this is one of the ones that creates some of the most misunderstanding.
Totally. This was this. I was literally thinking about this with regard to colleagues I work with in another country who rarely follow through in the way that I would follow through, who, you know, are late to meetings a lot, that sort of thing. And I put a moralistic Like, it upsets me, and I think in my head somewhere like, well, that they're bad, or they're not how we're working, or and when I read this and I made that adjustment, like in my being, it was like I saw it completely differently. And I recognize, no, that's this is a cultural difference, and just because we're both English speaking doesn't mean that that's not completely just the way this culture operates.
Yeah, I was interacting one time with an Afrikaans, a white Dutch South African boss, who was extremely frustrated by the degree to which many of his employees were always late. There was always an excuse. And one day somebody said to him, like, imagine the process that it just takes you to get to work in the morning and the number of things that might, you know, stop you, whether it's an acquaintance that comes to talk to you, whether it's people are on strike today, the traffic lights, the robots aren't working, like all the things that kind of make it difficult to be punctual. And then he said, yeah, but that's also just an excuse, you know, kind of the moralizing. Yeah. And what I would say is there are times too when like none of those things happen on the way to work, but it becomes so ingrained to you that similar to how monochronic people would say a queue is when we all stand in line in an orderly fashion. Whereas, you know, you may go to a place like India and like, wow, this is an interesting process toward queuing here. It's not always that like, there's some interrupting event that's causing them to not queue, but back to the power of culture, when you've been primed all your life, like, well, kind of the person who butts ahead is the one who gets there, even if there isn't a real reason in that particular moment, it's now so ingrained in our behavior. And I love the way you used it to part of it is, we're not going to change our colleagues' orientation to this, so do I at least have a frame of reference to stop getting so irritated, if nothing else for my own benefit, because I'm
really no, it's way better. It's like, yeah. Why am I getting mad about this?
Right.
And you use that driving metaphor in another way in the book where you talk about, you know, what happens to us when we're driving in a new place, you know, mm-hmm. that's unfamiliar to us.
Yeah.
And can you talk about that? Because I think that brought up sort of emotionally for me that people would maybe understand then, and how they're meeting other cultures that are also foreign to them.
Yeah, thanks, Kelly. Yeah, it's this whole idea that we, any of us who drive, have experienced that if I'm driving in a familiar place, you know, I can be listening to a podcast, I can be having a lively conversation with someone, have the music cranked up, cruise control on. Then what happens? Suddenly there's unexpected construction zone, or we're driving into a city that's unfamiliar. You know, we say to our passengers, like, hang on, I really need to focus here. We turn down the radio. No one necessarily told us we needed to do that. It's like, I need to like give this my entire attention. That's part of what I'm after with calling leaders to think about cultural intelligence. Like, I'm not trying to turn every single thing into, oh, it's a cultural thing. But hey, when culture is involved, at least stop, take the cruise control off and put your antenna up and go, wait. Like, what typically means someone's being rude in this setting may mean something entirely different for me.
You say in the book, quote, going with the flow isn't as easy if you don't know which direction the flow is going.
Yeah.
that
I mean,
hurts.
So many times I've experienced that. I think, oh, okay, I get where this is going. Then like, oh, actually, you know, I share an illustration in the book about, you know, I had primed myself thinking I was going to be much more prepared than I was in Liberia when I was meeting with a guy in the Philippines who, you know, unlike your colleague in this experience earlier today, thought this is going to be a meeting where we sit and it's relationship building, you know, even though I knew they were talking about bringing me in for an event. And we sit down to dinner and he right away was like, so how much is this going to cost me? And I'm like, oh, dinner's on me, you know, a Filipino guy. And he's like, no. I mean, like, if we bring you in to do this conference. And I'm like, oh, we can get to that, you know, kind of like your guy. Tonight's about getting to know each other and socializing. Like, well, then this is a waste of time for me if we aren't going to get right down to brass tacks. And so it's that reminder that turning off the cruise control also means don't just default to Filipinos just want to like socialize when they're talking business. This guy was an anomaly. And here's where it becomes this really sophisticated thinking it through, because at first I'm like, he's adjusting to me. He thinks this is the way America. And then as he kept giving cues, like, no, I do not just want to chit chat with you, brother. Like, I want to find out what the bottom line cost is here. So eventually I adapted. But to your point, I went in thinking the flow was going to be tonight's about, you know, eating some good food, talking about our kids, and Oh, no, we are immediately talking budget and bottom line.
So I'm curious. All right. So you and I are probably, we're roughly in the same sort of age range and socioeconomic background, Midwestern, all that stuff. And you like me have become more humble as we've gotten older with regard to like well-read. We've got the science for these things. We're talking about these things, but we recognize, of course, we're still going to screw this up. And yet there's this whole, all this evidence around Dunning-Kruger effect that like the so many people who have this sort of level of confidence and all that don't see these things and aren't humble. And I'm curious for you, like, what kept you curious? What kept you? I know what it is for me, but I'm curious for you, what kept you humble?
Two things I would say. One is that you do keep making mistakes. If you're actually going to, put your neck out there and try it and not retreat, you're not, I mean, I could share examples from the last week where I said something in a corporate engagement with a person of color. And afterward, I'm like, crap, I wonder if that landed right. I have no relationship with them, et cetera. And then the other thing, you and I talked about this a little bit before. I'm a person of faith, and while my faith has evolved a lot throughout the years, I think there is a sense of transcendence that I walk with that says, I haven't figured this whole thing out yet. So those are two things that come to mind for me. But what's your answer to it?
Yeah, so it's a couple things. It was sort of the midlife crisis of, after I wrote my book and I stepped down from producing at Second City, and so I lost my identity in some regards, and then found that I hadn't, and that I was adding on, like the house was here, and I luckily got an addition, and that was like, oh, that's interesting, and knowing that. Some people treated me differently in one regard, but then other people treated me, better in another regard. And so that was just,
Interesting.
I was able to stand outside my realm, but still within my realm. And that is a rare gift for that.
Yeah.
And the other, quite frankly, was when we lost our child. So when Nora died, when she was 17, 5 years ago, you don't go through a thing like that
Can't even
and
imagine.
not be ultimately changed, and you can let it ruin you, but like for Anne and I, that situation, we have a son and we've got great friends and we've got great jobs, and we're like, okay, well, what's the opposite of not letting it ruin us? And it's like, inform us, how do we want to live precious years, and that changes the equation. And I think the other thing that it did, and maybe that's because we were so open about it, was it signals to other people that they can treat you differently. There's a sort of leveling through pain and trauma and grief. Well, oh, and the other thing is because then people tell you what they've been going through, and no one is unscarred, right?
But I didn't know that about you. I'm
Oh,
sorry. I
yeah.
can't even wrap my mind around that. And I can imagine the limp that that then creates in how you walk through life.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I did a keynote this week because I always tell Nora stories, especially we used a lot of the techniques that we worked on, my wife and I, in our project with University of Chicago, and we created an Improv for Caregivers program. So all this stuff was part of that journey. And then someone at the end was sort of like, so how's your daughter? And you're on stage in front of 200 people. And I'm like, she didn't make it. But I know what I'm going to say. I go, but thank you for asking. And I said, here's the deal. I'm looking at all of you, and all of you have a pain that is maybe similar. Some of you maybe exactly similar. And the heads start nodding. And then, but people don't talk about it. It's not a norm. At least in this culture, it isn't necessarily a norm. I'm lucky that at a place like Second City, I mean, it's a comedy theater that has a lot of drama, and a lot of sharing, and that was, so I recognize my privilege in that situation. But certainly in corporate America, there's not a space for grief.
And do you see that changing at all generationally? Do you?
Oh yes. Well, yeah. I mean, COVID and George Floyd, and absolutely. I mean, and here's an interesting, so let's go there with this. So I referenced it before, but I've always been interested in John Haidt's work. And he's someone I've talked to about coming on the podcast. And I didn't have him on with his last book, in part because I feel what he and Gene Twenge, who I did have on the podcast, I think what they're missing a little bit is we have spent the last 10 to 15 years telling young people that their feelings matter and that they should feel free to share those feelings. And I think they listened. And I think that is inconvenient for a lot of people.
Interesting. So you're not convinced it's solely
social media?
Digital. Yeah, exactly.
No, because every generation blames the latest tech. That is, remember video games?
I'm not quite through Height's Anxious Generation, but that's a really fascinating insight.
The radio, I mean, Elvis was going to turn people to Satan, TV,
television,
video games, and now social. And the data is small. I mean, that is just true. And here's the other thing. We don't have enough. We don't know. We're too close to it. We'll maybe know more in 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years. I don't know. And I'm fascinated by this intersection of AI and human and what humans do. Because it's here and it's not going away. That's not how this works. And if I'm wrong, you know, the world's going to be blown up. So no one will talk about it.
Right. Yet.
But I do. I mean, the generation thing is interesting because I do go back to this idea of like in most, what I at least I understand is that for in most cases generations share the sort of crucial things of relationship and being seen and that sort of thing, and the changes are kind of based on like, well, what was happening when you were born that was a little bit different. You know, I mean, I recall we were the first on our block to have Atari Pong. Which is a little bit different from Call of Duty.
Yeah, exactly.
How are people responding to this latest edition as opposed to other editions?
I think what I hear most that people appreciate, which was a little hard for me as an academic, is that there's a lot more how-to. There's less time on the what cultural intelligence is and why you need it, and much more quickly pivots to and how do you do it. And it's interesting if I hearken back to your earlier question about get to the point. In some ways, I was responding to the get to the point crowd. There's all this kind of, I already felt like I had truncated the research in the previous editions to, you know, just bite size. But I think that's a piece where people are like, yeah, we're on board, but tell me what I actually do differently as a leader. And then I think, you know, it's sort of right where you started in today's conversation. Even though I would have always said in previous editions that culture is much bigger than nationality, 90% of my examples were all nationality. So I think bringing out some of these other ways that culture emerges for us, you know, is resonating for people, particularly right now when we're 4.5 weeks out from another consequential election. Consequential seems to be the adjective of this election period. And as you know well, with people feeling strongly on both sides of it. So I don't think cultural intelligence is entirely the answer to it, but at least one more tool to say, can we slow down and see how some of this is a reflection of our cultural differences, even though we may look alike, have the same passports, etc.
It's a strange time that way, because, you know, if you're talking 10, 15 years ago, we still had to do a lot of convincing of why you would have the comedy troupe come in and teach improvisation. We're pretty well past that. I mean, I just spent a week at Quantico working with the FBI National Academy. They loved it. They loved it. And these people did not share our politics or our worldview, for the bulk of them. And I know this because it was brought up. But when we were just focusing on the exercise work, to a person, they were like, got it. Like, completely get why this is good practice for when I'm in on the streets in a situation that might be dangerous or a case. And the interesting thing too is they have a whole, at Quantico for the FBI, they have a whole like Hollywood backlot where they practice this stuff. It's a subdivision. It's a bunch of stores. There's a replica of the Biograph Theater here in Chicago that is there. I took a picture of it. And it's very funny. And the groups of stores, they're all these, like, they're fake, right? Except there is one real store and it's a Subway.
Oh.
I'm like, why is this? Like, we don't know, but it's a working Subway. I'm like, all right, like, we can get a sandwich. Is that a similar thing for you in terms of your work? Yeah.
Yeah, I think there sometimes tends to be an assumption of you must be left-leaning if you're talking about culture and diversity, et cetera. But then on the other side of it, you know, I'm not necessarily proud of it, but I'll have like CEOs who will behind closed doors whisper in my ear, like, yeah, we're not really on the DEI woke agenda. However, we have people from all different places who need to get their work done and whatever it takes to help do that. So we don't really want to call it DEI, but the longer they start talking about it, I'm like, you're basically talking DEI.
You're talking about the same thing. I know. So, that's the problem. Yeah. You know, and that, again, the problem today is that we're talking past each other and we share so much more. If you really had the conversation, you would be so shocked that these people have, you know, 25 things that could connect you to them. And it's one thing that you might disagree on. And that is often it's a banal thing often, but you know, next thing to solve. All right. So we always ask our guest for, you know, a yes and story, which you shared last time you were here. So for returning guests, we ask for a thank you because story. Do you have one for us?
I do. Thank you because. So I thought about one of the roles I had early in my career. I was working for a nonprofit and the founder who was CEO of the nonprofit was stepping aside and he and the board asked me to take on the role, which pretty young in my career was exciting to me. I'm about 6 months in and it's pretty clear to me the founder's not ready to step aside. You know, he's very involved in things and actually having closed door meetings, the meeting with the board that I'm not aware of. So I sort of called it and just said like, hey, looks like you're not ready to be done with this. I'm still excited about the vision. And you know, the board, my thank you to the board was the board and the founder were like, we still want you to do this, but not at the expense of him not still being involved. He's going to do what he wants. He started this organization. And I was like, then I'm not the right guy for this. And so I walked away and it didn't feel like a thank you at the moment, but I was really grateful for their clarity. Within a week later, fortuitously, that's when I first met Soon Ang, the pioneering researcher of cultural intelligence, and, you know, then became what's now been a 20-year career of, you know, focused almost entirely around this. So while they didn't necessarily intend it for that, I'm glad that they shot straight with me. And quite frankly, I don't know that I would have had much mental capacity to really think about this space that's ended up being so life-giving to me and feels like it's an important contribution. So thank you for not giving up power and control so that I could go chase the thing that really mattered to me.
I love it. The book is called Leading with Cultural Intelligence, The Real Secret to Success. David Livermore, thanks for coming back on the podcast.
Thank you, Kelly.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. Soul, screaming atop their lungs.
survive.